Hello, and welcome to Rabbit Box Radio Hour. My name is Daniel Rodriguez Granrose, and I'm the director of Rabbit Box. Rabbit Box fosters the art of storytelling in Athens, Georgia, by providing a monthly forum for people to tell true stories about a given theme, live and without notes. The theme for today's Radio Hour is My Life in Black and White. Stories from this Radio Hour were pulled from our archive of over 300 stories and will include stories ranging from A Long Night for the Percy Sledgehammer Band, all the way to a story of an arrest made by the first black police officer in Athens, Georgia. Our first story for the hour comes from Valden Daniels, performed in May of 2014 from her Silver Box series for seniors. The theme for the night was Silver Box, My Life in Black and White.
I grew up here in Athens, in Broad Acres. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Broad Acres, it's the projects here in Athens. If you're going down from the varsity, when you go down the hill there, those projects on the right, that's Broad Acres. So I'm a native Athenian. All of my life I was raised here. So I'm happy about Athens. But my mom was a maid, Mr. Ayers. My mom was a maid, and she worked in Five Points. There were six of us in the house. My father worked at the poultry. Every morning at 4 a.m., my mom would get up and fix breakfast for my father and all six of us. She would leave at 6:30, walk to Five Points, okay? She would clean, iron, cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the family. And she loved that family. Truly, there were times I felt neglected because she would say to us, that's our family. And it became a part of us, that family in Five Points. My father, he would leave at 4:30, soon as he got breakfast, and go to the poultry. Now, my mom worked from 7 in the morning, and she got back home at 6 in the afternoon. She made $3 a day. $3 a day. My father, he worked at the poultry. Now, mind you, he got there at 5 o'clock. He would get back at 6:30, and he made 75 cents an hour, but they only paid him $6 a day. So he was working a lot more than what he was being paid for. Sometimes they worked on Saturday. It did not matter, but he worked. Now, I grew up right up Broad Acres. There was a store across the street called Aiken Groceries. And here I am. This is 1959. I am 12 years old. I had been working at Ms. Aiken's store for over a year. Now, be honest with you, Miss Aiken hired a white lady to come in on Saturday, because Saturdays, you have to picture, in a black neighborhood, there was no Kroger's, no Winn-Dixie's. That little store was it for getting your food and groceries. That was it. So on Saturday, that store is packed out, literally. It is wall to wall. Now, there I would wait on the kids. I would wait on the adults. I would stock it. I would clean it up. I would do everything in that store you can imagine as a 12-year-old. I started a year ago. I'm working at 11 in the store. And I noticed one slip Miss Aiken made. One afternoon she paid me, and I got paid $1 a Saturday. And I noticed that Mrs. Anderson, the white lady, she got $5. Now, I felt like I could take the groceries to the neighborhood. I could outcount them all up in the store. I mean, I could outcount any of those ladies there. I was a better math person, and they knew that. I could do things they couldn't do. I could go to the neighborhood. They were not going. I could go. I could wait on any and everybody, but I couldn't ring up the cash register, and I'm making $1. So I went home to my mom one Saturday, and I said to her, she called me Roosevelt, so my mom called me Roosevelt. She said, Roosevelt, what's wrong with you? You upset? I said, look, Ma, they're paying Mrs. Anderson $5 a Saturday, and I'm only making a dollar. That is not right. She said, what do you mean? I said, that's not right. They are paying that white lady more than I'm making. I could do twice as much, three times what she's doing, but she's making $5. They're not going to, no, look, Roosevelt, I'm making $3 a day. They're not going to pay you what they're paying that white lady. It's not going to happen. So here I am, 12 years old. I said, now, look, I got to figure out what I can do here. That's not right. So the next Saturday, just a little child, I went back over to Miss Anderson. And I said, Miss Anderson, you're making $5. I'm making a dollar. That's not right. She said, well, Miss Aiken's making pay. Okay, let's talk to Miss Aiken. So I went to Miss Aiken. I said, Miss Aiken, I am making a dollar, and Miss Anderson is making $5. That's not right. And she said to me, boy, you lost your last mind. It is no way I'm going to pay you what I'm paying Miss Anderson. I said, okay, all right. So I went back. I waited till the store got jam-packed. I mean, there's wall-to-wall people in there. Okay, now I looked at her. I said, I want to run the cash register, and I want to make $5 a Saturday. Oh, I'm not working here. She said, go then. I walked out of the store. Now, mind you, that store is packed. Children running around. I said, yeah, I'm out of here. 1 hour passed. I got home. My mom said, what are you doing here? I said, Mom, I told you I am not working for that dollar. Boy, you crazy. Them white folk not going to pay you that. Your daddy making $6. I'm making $3. You going to make $5. Well, I'm not working for it. It's not fair. I am not going to do it. 2 hours passed. 2.5 hours, the phone rang. My mama picked it up. She said, that's Miss Aiken, Roosevelt. She says she's going to pay you $5. I tell you this, at an early age, timing is everything. Have a great day.
You just listened to a story from Valden Daniels from May of 2014. All of our stories can be found uncensored and uncut on rabbitbox.org. Next on Rabbit Box Radio Hour, we have a story by Alfred Cooper from his time on tour as the drummer for Percy Sledge and the Sledgehammer Band. Alfred told his story in September of 2013. The theme for the night was, I'm with the band.
Back in the day, we were on what you call a chitlin circuit. Jim Hawkins is familiar with that. And this story is a story that happened with the Percy Sledge Band in Slidell, Louisiana. We spent 3 years down there one night. So we were coming from a gig, and somehow we got off I-10. We were going through Slidell, and Twiggs Lennon, who is John Lennon's brother, was Percy's road manager at the time. And back then on the chitlin circuit, the road manager was the driver. He was the valet. If you were short of a musician, he got up there and faked it like he was a musician. But we were coming through to Slidell, Louisiana one morning about 6 o'clock. All of a sudden, we saw these red lights. They didn't have blue lights then behind us. So we pulled over. Percy was driving this Twiggs was his chauffeur driving this 1968 Fleetwood Broham Cadillac. Yes. We were behind him in a 1968 Chevrolet station wagon, red. All the names of the songs were on the station wagon. Percy Sledge and the Sledgehammer Band. had all the names of his songs on there. So we got pulled over. So when they pulled over, we pulled up right behind the Cadillac. So this officer told Twiggs Lindham, "How about stepping out the car, boy?" Twiggs got out, being Twiggs he was. "Morning, officer." We got pulled up right behind the Cadillac. Twiggs got out. The officer asked for his driver's license. He said, "Now let me ask you something." He says, "Is this a habit where you come from?" Twiggs said, "And what might that be, officer?" "A white boy driving a nigga around in a Cadillac." Twiggs said, "Well, this nigga pays my salary." And he says, "The hell you say? Who is this?" He said, "This is Percy Sledge." "Percy Sledge? He looks at the car behind the station wagon with the names of the songs. "When a Man Loves a Woman," "Out of Left Field," "It Tears Me Up." He says, "You know what? I think my daughter got some of them albums at home." Not albums, but albums. He says, "How about you stepping out the car?" So Percy gets out with his fire engine red smoking jacket. And at that time, a lot of the black entertainers had the processes with the rollers and the head rags. And Percy got out and he says, "Well, I didn't know you was a woman." He says, "Well, I'm not a woman, I'm Percy Sledge." So he gets out and he says, "You the one did these songs on this car?" Percy said, "Yes, sir." Percy came back to the station wagon, sat on the hood of the car. He said, "Well, I want to hear some of them songs." Percy said, "Well, I can't sing the songs without my guitar player." He told us at that time to get out of the station wagon. So we all got out of the station wagon. "Which one of you boys is the guitar player?" Jerry Weaver said, "I am." He says, "Come here." He says, "Now this boy said he can't sing without the guitar player. Now I want you to get your guitar and play behind him." He said, "Well, officer, the thing about it, I can't play the guitar without electricity." He says, "Now you see, that's where you all think I'm a damn fool. Who in the hell ever heard of a guitar needing electricity?" So Jerry goes to the trailer and he gets the guitar out and he's standing up there and Percy's standing on the hood of the, sitting on the hood of the car. And he says, "Let me hear a little bit of that Tears Me Up." So Jerry's strumming, you couldn't hear nothing. He's just strumming, then Percy's singing, "It tears me up, da, da, da. It tears me up. All right, let me hear a little of that Out of Left Field." Percy, "When these expected." Faith stumbles in, Jerry strumming, you ain't hear nothing. So a couple of more songs after about 35, 40 minutes, he says, "You know what? I believe you are Percy Sledge." He said, "Yes, sir, I'm Percy Sledge." So he says, "Well, I'll tell you what. You boys wondering why I stopped you." And we going, "Yes, sir." Twiggs say, "Well, officer, that is a good question." He says, "Well, we got a report that there was a U-Haul trailer coming down through here with a bunch of marijuana on it. And it looked just like this trailer. Now, you got 500,000 U-Haul trailers that look just alike, but he's specifying that this is the one." He says, "Well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you boys go ahead on, and y'all have a nice day." Now, how in the hell you going to have a nice day? Percy Sledge, instead of doing a concert in the hood, he did a concert on the hood of a car. But, you know, it's funny now, but when you think about the reality of the situation, it could have escalated into a more serious thing. We could have gotten shot. We could have gotten killed. But that's the thing back in the day about playing the chitlin circuit in the hood. I want to thank you all for having me here tonight. God bless.
For those of you who are just tuning in, you are listening to Rabbit Box Radio Hour. The theme for the hour is My Life in Black and White. The story you just heard was performed by Alfred Cooper in September of 2013. Our next story comes from the opposite side of the racial perspective, when Scott Shamp and his white grandfather encounter something they did not expect. Scott told his story in April of 2014. The theme of the night was Out on a Limb.
In the 1970s, my grandfather witnessed all his caustic convictions start to crumble. He had a hard time because everything that he grew up with had started to change. Let me give you an example. I caught him whistling Let It Be, even though he had forbid me from listening to the Beatles ever since that comment about being bigger than Jesus. My grandfather stopped reciting those nasty limericks about un-American priests after he spent the afternoon fishing with my Catholic friend Steve Cebulski. And I was with my grandfather on the day that he realized it was hard to hate someone who helped you, someone who was willing to go out on a limb for you. When my mother and father divorced, I moved in with my grandfather. And my grandfather embarked on this angry campaign of curing me of my looming effeminacy with a whole campaign of things like cleaning fish and working on tractors and feeding cows, manly things to do. Because of my grandfather's eyes, there was just so much wrong with me. I had long hair, I read too much, and I wore short pants. I think the short pants bothered him the most. And I mean, I never even got that because we lived in the South. It was hot all the time. Short pants just made sense to me. And it wasn't like my grandfather wore long pants in private. If it got hot for him, he just took off his pants and walked around in his grimy boxers everywhere he went. You just got used to seeing my grandfather in his underwear everywhere. And then I was with my grandfather on the day that we were working at the farm, a hot Sunday on the farm. And we were working on that big green John Deere tractor. That thing was a menace. For every minute that it ran, you had to work on it for an hour. And my job was all about handing my grandfather the wrong tool while he worked on the tractor. That was another thing that was wrong with me, is I didn't seem to understand the difference between a Phillips head and a flathead screwdriver. And my grandfather, of course, didn't have any pants on while it was happening. That was just the way he rolled. And then all of a sudden we realized that we were going to be late to church if we didn't leave right away. This farm was about 40 miles away from my home. And so we jumped in the car and we start driving back to my home in Conyers. And about midway back, we noticed that the car is about out of gas. So we pull over to a gas station on the side of the road. And my grandfather tells me to get out and pump $5 worth. And I mean, it was long before self-serve, but you know, it was one of those small gas stations, the one pump variety where you could pump your own. So I pump the gas and I go around to my grandfather's window and I say, "The money, Granddaddy?" And I watch as my grandfather reaches back for where his wallet should be. He's left his pants on the wheel of the tractor back at the farm 30 miles away. And I see my grandfather look at me and say, "You didn't remind me?" And I realized I'd gotten so used to seeing my grandfather walk around in those dirty boxer shorts, it just made sense. So he looked at me and said, "Do you have $5? And I said, "My net worth at that point in time was 10 whole dollars, and you don't carry around half your treasury in your pockets of those short pants." So my grandfather starts to panic, and he looks around, and he sees a black man just about his age sweeping out the grocery store connected to the gas station. So my grandfather calls over and says, "Hey, send your boss out here," to the man. And the man looks at my grandfather and says, "Mister, I own this place." And the way he stretched out that word "own," it really made you realize he was proud of that fact. So my grandfather looks at him and he goes, "Okay, you come over here." And when you looked in that man's eyes, you know that he had been warned about approaching white men's cars when people were calling to you from the side of the road. So he looked at my grandfather and said, "Why don't you come over here?" And that's when my grandfather yelled back, "I can't. I don't have any pants on." For the life of me, I still can't realize why my grandfather thought that would make him more comfortable coming over to the car. But I guess curiosity got the better of him because he walked over. And my grandfather explained the whole situation to him. And the guy said, "So you don't have any money?" And my grandfather says, "I've got money. It's back at the farm." And the man says, "So you can't pay me?" And my grandfather says, "I can pay you after I get my money." And the man says, "So you want to pump this gas and drive off without paying me?" My grandfather's exasperated, so he goes, "Okay, I'll leave the spare tire for my car." And the man looks at my grandfather and goes, "I got plenty of spare tires." And then my grandfather gets an idea, and he looks at me. And he says, "I'll leave the boy with you." And you can tell this guy's starting to enjoy it because a smile starts to creep on his face, and you can tell that he's realizing that he has a better deal with that spare tire. And he says, "What am I going to do with a white boy if you don't come back?" And then the man did something that you could tell that he did naturally, something that came to him without even thinking about it. He reached up and he put his hand on my shoulder. And he just said, "Go on." And then he started to walk back to his sweeping. Well, my grandfather called after him, "We'll be back in 45 minutes. The man doesn't answer. He just picks up the broom and starts sweeping again. You know, all the way down to the farm to get my grandfather's pants and all the way back, we didn't talk to each other at all. And the entire way I was wondering if he was thinking the same thing I was thinking. I was wondering if the shoes had been on the other feet, if my grandfather would have gone out on a limb for that black man. When we got back to the station, I started to get out of the car because going to pay the man would be the kind of small errand that I was expected to do. But my grandfather just said, "Stay in the car." And he got out a $5 bill and he walked over to the man and handed it to him. Now, they were too far away for me to actually hear what they said, but they talked for a minute. And then my grandfather started laughing. And then the black man started laughing. And then my grandfather pointed at his pants and he laughed even harder. And then the black man started laughing, and that black man did the thing that came so natural to him. He reached up and put his hand right on my grandfather's shoulder. And my grandfather turned around and looked right at me. And the black man took his hand away because he realized the moment had changed. You know, I don't think my grandfather was a racist. For me, a racist is a blatant hater. You know, my grandfather's bigotry was propped up with subtle inaction all the time. It wasn't anything overt. That look on my grandfather's face when he made eye contact with me showed that he was in turmoil. He didn't know what was going on. Everything had changed in his world. And what really got to me at that point in time was I realized, and I think he realized, standing at that gas station with a black man's hand on his shoulder, a black man who had been willing to go out on the limb for him, my grandfather realized that things had changed forever and they were never going to be the same again.
You are listening to Rabbit Box Radio Hour. The story you just heard was told by Scott Shamp in April of 2014. Up next, we have a story from a former Rabbit Box board member, Ernest Thompson. Ernest told his story in May of 2014. The theme of that month was Silver Box, My Life in Black and White.
I was born and raised in Charleston, South Carolina, and when I was about 5 years old, yes, Charleston, America's most historic city, Ms. Johnson just took you to Columbia, South Carolina. That's a pretty nice city, too, Ms. Johnson. But At 5 years old, I lived in this integrated neighborhood right there. And we're talking 1940s, the early 1940s. But white and black families lived side by side in one of these typical Charleston houses. They are long, narrow houses with long porches downstairs and upstairs and yards in between the houses and backyards that extend behind the houses. The children, the white and black kids, played together on the sidewalks every day, hopscotch, dodgeball, road tricycles, with no incidents, no problems whatsoever. Okay? Now, there were certain rules that I didn't notice until many years later, really. And one of those rules was that we did not go into white kids' yards, and they did not come into our yards. But when I was 5 years old, I didn't even really notice this. The adults in the neighborhood, black and white, really did not socialize. But my mom had an over-the-fence sort of relationship with the white lady next door. She would talk from her upstairs window, and my mom would stand on the porch, and they would hold long conversations. And so we got along great for several years, and then one of the white families moved away, and a new white family moved into the neighborhood. Now, almost immediately, my mom told me, look, don't you and Ernestine, my sister, have anything to do with those people. They are nothing but poor white trash. Well, I mean, I was very impressed. My mom had never said that about any of the other families in the neighborhood. So naturally, that made quite an impression. A few days after that family was there, Ernestine and I went out into the backyard to play. We run into the backyard, and lo and behold, there is this white kid in our yard. I mean, this is unheard of, right? I never thought about it before, but this was out of place. And the kids, he's picking some azaleas that grow wild in our yard. He's there picking the azaleas. And when we come into the yard, he turns and looks at us, but then he says nothing and turns back and continues picking the flowers, which I take as kind of an insult. And so now, since my mom's already put a label on him, I don't know what to say except, get out of our yard. And the kid then turns to me and he says, I'm in my yard. Now we really have a problem, right? Because this violates my territorial instincts, right? So now words start to fly back and forth, and I really don't remember who threw out the first racial epithet, but the racial epithets start to fly, and pretty soon we are throwing rocks at each other. And Ernestine and I, being two against one, we really don't have a great deal of trouble driving him out of the yard and back into his yard. And just near the end of our exchange of rocks, however, one of my rocks catches him right in the middle of the chest. He falls and sits right on his rump. Then he jumps up and runs screaming to his house, right? Ernestine and I run into the house to tell Mom what has happened, and Mom's very upset because she told us to stay away from those people. And Mom didn't think that chasing this kid out of the yard was staying away from them. But now Mom is concerned those people are going to be coming after us, she says. Well, this is about noon, somewhere in midday when it happens, and they don't come, nothing happens, but then as dark falls, sure enough, Ernestine looks out the window. She says, Mom, these people are coming. And you look out the window and hear these flashlights on the ground. It's this whole gang of people coming. And I'd heard of the Ku Klux Klan. I'd never seen them, but I figured that must have been it, right? This gang of men are coming. And they're yelling. You can hear them before they even get close. Mom grabs me by the hand, takes me out on the porch. On this long porch, she takes me away from our apartment to the front apartment where we don't live. She says she doesn't want them to know exactly where we live. So she's standing on the porch as they run up cursing, and she tries to shame them. She says, You ought to be ashamed of yourself, a bunch of you men coming at this little boy, and they're saying, well, you get his daddy out here so we can kick his behind. And she says, if his daddy was here, you wouldn't be in this yard. This goes on, and ugly racial terms get thrown around. And then a policeman steps forward and says, shut up to my mom. Why don't you shut up? He used the N-word at her. And the white lady who lived next door sticks her head out the window at this point and says, why are you telling her to shut up? Tell them to shut up, talking about the white men. She says, they're the ones making all the noise. And for a moment, I'm hopeful that this white lady can stop all this, right? But, of course, that doesn't happen. They pretty much ignore her and go on about their business of yelling and screaming. I grab mom. I'm just burying my head in her skirt trying to hide from this thing. The policeman eventually gives my mama some papers, which means that I have to go to court. So I spend a couple of weeks there worrying about this business that I might have to go to reform school until I'm 21. That couldn't really happen, could it? Well, I don't know. You know, I'm 8 years old by this time. I'm sorry, I took you into this when I was five. It was about 3 years before that family moved away. So I'm really now about 8 years old. But as far as I know, you know, white people do what they want to do. If they want to put an eight-year-old boy in, maybe they can do that. Finally, the day come to go to court. Court is downtown on what we call the old Citadel Green. The university, the military school, used to be there a long, long time ago. By this time, it had already moved up to North Charleston. But the Citadel, the building still stood there in its Gothic stone structure. And as I approach this thing on court day, I can easily imagine that in this huge structure, there are dungeons there where they keep little boys that throw rocks at white kids, right? And we approach this building, and as you go into the court, we go into a side door that says colored entrance over the top. And when we get inside, you know, there are these signs, white restroom, colored fountain, white section of the courtroom, colored section. It's kind of hard to know that you're going to be treated fairly in that environment, but and the judge walks in, and I'm pretty impressed. Black robe, white-haired man. I'm pretty impressed. I don't think mom was very impressed. The judge tries to run the court. Now, my mom had about a fourth-grade education, but one thing she always said, she said that she was as good as anybody, black or white, and she told me that. Ernest, you're as good as anybody, black or white, and she made me believe it. And this day, mom was determined to put on a show and show me that she meant it. The judge was up there trying to run the court according to his rule. Well, my mom didn't know the rules, but she wasn't going to back down. And as the judge went there talking about trying to read this paper that had been written up for the white lady, my mom is saying, why don't I have a paper written up for me? Only white people gets papers written up for them. Of course, the judge is getting angry and angry. And finally, he tells her to shut up or he'll put her in jail. Now I'm really upset because even my mom might go to jail. Well, finally, they call me up and the judge tells me to repeat after him. I will never again go in the Kramer Yard. And I'm saying, I never went in. And no, repeat after me. So I have to repeat after him and promise never to do again something that I never did in the first place. But in the end, all I got was a reprimand, a warning not to ever do it again. So things turn out much better than they might have. I can think of many points where this might have turned into a real disaster. Now, my sister, from that point on, she continued to play with the white girls in the neighborhood. I don't recall that I ever again played with white kids in Charleston. Unfortunately, I never got to meet the boy who loved azaleas. The hole in the fence that he had come through, where the planks in the fence were missing, those were boarded up, and so I never got to see that little boy and never even learned his name, unfortunately. And so I want to say here tonight, if it just so happens that the boy who loves Azaleas is in the room, I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
In the civil rights era, as with now, justice and injustice often comes down to decisions made by the court. In keeping with our theme for the hour, we have two more stories, each with a first-hand account from a high-profile court case during the civil rights era. This next story is another story from our May of 2014 show, My Life in Black and White. Here, former Congressman Donald Johnson transports us into a stifling courtroom divided by race.
I'm going to tell this story just sort of from the beginning and then build into how I fit into it. But and many of you I know are familiar with the case of the murder of Lieutenant Colonel Lemuel A. Penn, who was from Washington, D.C. He was served in the U.S. Army Reserves and happened to have been driving back from Fort Benning under his service, time of service there in the reserves. And so he was driving back with two other officers from Fort Benning. They went down every year for 2 weeks training. And there was another lieutenant colonel and another major. And they planned to drive the whole night through from Columbus, Georgia, at Fort Benning, all the way through. When they got to Athens, they stopped at the Confederate Memorial, of all places, to change drivers. And Lieutenant Colonel Lemuel Penn began to drive. He took over from one of the other colleagues. And they had the unfortunate circumstance of having a car pass by and see them get into their car and see the license plate on their car. And this was between 3 and 4 a.m. And they see this car with a D.C. license plate, and they immediately start following it out of town. They drive past their own Broad Street. They turn on North Thomas and go past Doherty and Washington. And I mention those because that was the hangout for the Klan at that time. Now, the Klan didn't overtake Athens at that time. I think we had a population of about 50,000 people at the time, and there were about 50 people who were active Klansmen. But they were very active, and they would drive around at night, shoot in that neighborhood, in black neighborhoods, and just generally harass people, and got away with it for the most part. But on this occasion, they followed these gentlemen out, and they decided to follow them all the way out to the Broad River Bridge. But they as they drove across the Broad River Bridge going from Elbert County to Madison County, they pull up beside Lemuel Penn's car, one of them pulls out a sawed-off shotgun and blasts the driver and kills him immediately. And the other two are able to grab the wheel and pull it over before it, you know, crashes over the bridge and whatnot. And they were able to turn around and come back. Now I'm going to jump forward. This is the crime that happened. The reason it involves me is because my father was the Solicitor General. It was later called the District Attorney. And it was his job, his duty, to prosecute that crime. So anyway, they had the trial. The question was, what was going to happen there in this case that didn't happen in others? But in any case, it was an eye-opener for me because my dad never talked to me about his law practice. He would come home mad sometimes because the jury didn't go his way. But this time, he wanted all of us to go, my sister, my older sister, and my mother, and I brought along a friend, and we went to this trial. It took place in Danielsville, but it was a case where it really looked like the scene from To Kill a Mockingbird. Because first of all, you had all the press out there from all over the world, literally. I mean, and you know, New York Times, Washington Post, they were all covering it, and Time, Newsweek, all the big magazines were covering it, and the news footage is you can still see some of this from the Russell Library that they have it. So it was a big trial, and you walk into the courtroom, which this is in August, and it was sweltering hot in there. And, of course, it was segregated. So all of the African-American people were sitting up in the balcony. But in any case, they presented a very strong case. One of the driver, this guy Lackey, gave a statement and basically outlined what happened, you know, from the beginning to end. You know, he said, for example, that the original reason for our following the colored men was because we had heard that Martin Luther King might make a Georgia a testing ground with the Civil Rights Bill. And we had intended scaring off any out-of-town colored people before they could give us any trouble. I mean, that was the whole idea about it. So what I'm going to do is now just give you my father's closing argument and then some, you know, poignant phrases from it. Not the whole thing, because it lasted for over an hour. But this was the thing that had such an impact on me, not just the trial, but his speech and the way he handled himself. It says, now the evidence shows that these three men started out following Penn and his two companions with a conspiracy in mind for the purpose of intimidating, for the purpose of assaulting, for the purpose of harassing members of the colored race. They didn't know that there was such a person in the world by the name of Lemuel Penn. The only thing they knew about Lemuel A. Penn was that he was born a Negro. You don't have a right to shoot a man because he came into this world with black skin. Now, is that a crime? Would that justify a man taking a shotgun and blowing his head off because he was black? It's not right, gentlemen. It's not right. These three men deliberately followed that car down that road for the purpose of committing indiscriminate murder. These Negroes had bothered no one. There were no threats, no menaces on the part of these men. This killing was all unprovoked, and there was no mitigating circumstances. It was just cold-blooded assassination. Can law-abiding, peace-loving citizens find shelter in this courthouse? These night riders out here striking at unsuspecting people. And I submit to you that Lieutenant Colonel Lemuel A. Penn was a human. He could feel pain. He wanted to live. He thought as much of his life as these defendants think of theirs. He thought as much of his life as you do. And he had the right to live. Gentlemen, have the courage to do what's right. Now, I'm going to end there with his speech. Unfortunately, the state of Georgia's honor lost that day. To me, at the end of this case, and I am going to wrap it up, at the end of this case, as we drove home, my parents and I and my sister and my little friend, who was, he and I played football together. We were about to start football practice again, and he looked over at me after my father concluded the speech, and I wasn't sure what kind of, you know, attitude he would have to it, because there was, you know, there were a lot of people in the schools who were giving me a hard time about my dad prosecuting this case. You know, one day I came home from school, and there was a sticker on the door that said, "The Knights of the Ku Klux Klan is watching you." They didn't know the grammar that well, but they knew how to scare the hell out of people. And I still have that to this day. I'll save that for the rest of my life to show it to my children. But what my father showed me was the strong sense of duty, the strong sense of the knowing the difference between right and wrong.
Our final story for Rabbit Box Radio Hour is told by one of the first two black police officers in Athens, Georgia, the late Reverend Archibald Roosevelt Killian. The Reverend told a story in May of 2013. The theme for the night was Living History.
tonight, I thought I would take a chapter out of a biography that I'm writing. It is entitled To Protect and Serve, Not Just Incarcerate, and it takes us back in time. I had never intended to be a policeman in Athens. When the call came, I didn't want to answer it. Ray Ware, who had been a Tuskegee Airman, and Wilbur P. Jones, a businessman and community activist, were leaders of the black community of Athens, and they wanted black policemen. They had approached the city officials about it. I wasn't interested in that stuff. The city of Athens told them, if you can find two Negroes who are qualified, we will consider hiring them. I had been back in Athens from California 2 years. Mama said I should apply for the police position, but I was content to run my restaurant, the Four Seasons, the best restaurant in town for white or black, which was doing well on Broad Street. The storm surrounding the integration of the University of Georgia had died down a lot, but was still rumbling. Hamp Holmes was still living in our house. I told my mama, you're barking up the wrong tree. I ain't never went against what you said, but I'm about to do it now, because Archibald is not fixing to be a policeman in this 10-cent town. You can forget that. She said, you're to your people. I told you when you decided to keep Hamp in our home that you were here for that purpose. Now I'm telling you again that you are here for this purpose. I said, Mama, I ain't policing. I turned down the state police of Massachusetts, and I turned down a police job in L.A., and I'm sure not going to police in Athens. We discussed it back and forth. My cousin, Don Moon, had wanted to become a policeman. Everybody was telling me I owed it to society. So I finally told Mama, go on and put my name in, but I'm still not saying I'm going to take that job. Probably my training and experience as a military policeman in Germany during the Korean War was a major reason the police department decided to hire me. I completed Air Police School in Fort Gordon, Georgia. I was in the 36th Air Police Squadron. I policed in Germany, France, Luxembourg, and North Africa. I made airmen of a quarter. I made airman of the squadron 3 times. I made airman of group once. And I made airman of wing for 1/4 under Colonel Robert L. Scott from Macon, Georgia. That was something no person had done in the 36th Air Police Squadron before. I had met Police Chief E.E. Hart and other police officials in January of 61 when I had provided housing in my home for Hamilton Holmes, who along with Charlene Hunter had just integrated the University of Georgia. At the time, the police and the university officials helped me prepare to protect my home from an expected assault by the Klan. The Klan never showed up, maybe because the word got to them that I had called on a force of 30 African-American military veterans, friends who were ready, willing, and able to defend my home with arms if necessary. All of us ain't scared. My friends, members of my social club, SAFER, took turns on guard for several days. Because of all this, the police officials knew something about me. Moon and I were going to be sworn in as the first two policemen of color in Athens, Georgia. They were going to do it at the City Hall. We arrived at the City Hall that evening. Everybody and his brother was there. Chief Hardy met me at the door. That was a problem. He said, Killian, I told you that in order to be a policeman in Athens, you had to be registered to vote, and your name is not on the voting list. I said, Chief, I registered to vote before I went overseas in 1952, and I registered to vote since I've been back here. He said, I looked through the books, and I couldn't find it. We went downstairs in the basement of City Hall. The chief got the book. He went through it and said, I just don't see your name. I guess we're going to have to put this off. I said, Chief, have you looked in the other book? He knew I was talking about the white folks' book. In those days, you couldn't have black and white voters listed in the same book. The chief pulled out the white book, turned the key, and there was Archibald Roosevelt Killian. I said, that's me. He closed the door. Neither of us said anything. We went back upstairs. Chief Hardy told them he had just overlooked it, but my name was in the book. You see, in those days, for your driver's license and other papers, your race was put down by some official, not by you. They just looked at you and made a decision. My driver's license said white for 30 years. I once got stopped down in South Georgia. The state trooper looked at me, looked at my driver's license. He didn't know what to say because he was afraid to challenge it. The biggest insult you could do to a white man was suggest that he might be a Negro. So if they wasn't sure, they didn't ask. So on March 7, 1962, just a year and 2 months after integration of the University of Georgia, I became one of the first two persons of color to serve on Athens Police Force. My cousin, Donald Moon, who died in 64, was a brother black officer. A short time later, the department added two more African Americans, George Maxwell, now Athens Clark County District 3 Commissioner, and Robert Smith, deceased. Moon and I got a chilly reception at the police department. When we first started, policemen, white policemen wouldn't talk to us. Each day when they arrived, the white policemen had to go in City Hall to check the daily agenda. We blacks didn't go inside. We had standing orders to report to the garage area, clean and gas up all the police cars, and take the sorry car. So we did that, cleaned them, gassed them up, and took the most ragged one for ourselves. They didn't give us this dirty detail because we were rookies, but because we were black. I had this assignment for the entire time I was on the force. The only place we got treated halfway right was with Judge Olin Price up in City Recorder's Court. In those days, there were no blacks in the courtroom except defendants. Now, we did have some good captains, Captain Brown, Captain Seagrave. May they rest in peace. And we reported to the captain on duty. We didn't have to take orders from any lower level white officers. I found out that neither whites nor blacks wanted to be taking orders from black police. When we first started, nobody wanted us. The white folk didn't want us, the police didn't want us, and the Negroes didn't want us. I had Negroes tell me, "You ain't gonna put me in jail. Call the white police." We policed the black neighborhoods. We worked from 6 o'clock in the evening until 2 in the morning. Those were the hours they figured colored folks were more prone to get into stuff. My supervisor would call me and ask me how come I wasn't making more arrests. A whole lot of folks, they thought I should have locked up. I didn't, because the police are supposed to protect and serve, not just incarcerate. During the first 6 months, white policemen did everything they could to run us out of the department. Then we got into that battle at the club. We had been policemen about 6 months. There used to be a little club on Henderson Extension. One Sunday, Moon and I were driving by the club. These guys were standing out front, faking a fight, waiting on us. When we came by, they ran in the club, and Moon and I went in behind them. As soon as we got in, I told Moon, "Boy, we've been ahead." We took the shotguns from those Negroes and put four of them under arrest. So after the white policemen saw that we could handle ourselves, things started to change for the better. The understated understanding was that we could not arrest whites. I really didn't worry about arresting whites because I didn't have time. I had enough to do as it was. Usually white policemen would not answer calls from the black neighborhoods. These were left to us black officers. The first time I arrested a white man, it led to a humorous scene in court. Moon and I were on patrol one night, pretty near getting off time. We turned off Hancock, going past St. Mary's Hospital. That's when it was on Millage Avenue. There was a taxi cab sitting at the curb. The driver was waving at us to stop. I told Maxwell, "Look at this dude trying to tell us something." We stopped, and the taxi driver said, "I had this fella with me all night. I done took him to every house of ill repute in town. He's drunk, and I can't do anything more with him." I was just going to lay him here on the sidewalk and hope the folks in the hospital would see him and take him in. I said, "Well, we can't leave him lying there. We'll just take him to jail and charge him with public drunkenness. At least he will be safe for the night." So we took him in the police car to the jail. That's when the jail was on Boulevard. We took him in and booked him. The desk sergeant, Tootie, said, "Who you gonna put on as the arresting officer? I understand that he expects me to use a white officer's name in place of mine." When an officer arrested somebody, he had to be in court at 10 o'clock the next morning to present the case unless the defendant had bonded out. I said, "Well, I gotta come to court in the morning anyhow, just put me down." For a moment, he looked at me like I had lost my mind and said, "All right." The word got around town. Lord Killian done locked up a white man and put his own name down. Next morning, the courtroom was packed with folks. You couldn't get in. People were lining the walls. Judge Price handled the case. That cat, the defendant, got up and said, "Judge, I have been all over the world. I have been in jail everywhere. This is the first time I ever been locked up by a nigger." Judge Price stopped them cold. "We're not going to have that in here," he said. "Y'all didn't know that used to happen, but it did. But Judge, I'm a merchant seaman, and this nigger done stole my money." Miss C. Graves was the clerk of court. Judge asked her how much money did Officer Killian report this man as having. She reported the amount, which was a little over $2,000. The cat looked shocked. "Judge, I done been everywhere, every whole house in Georgia. I didn't think I had that much money. When I got off the ship in Savannah, I had $5,000. I thought I might have had a few dollars left. I done been all over the world, and the police always steal my money. Now I get arrested, he changed it to a colored man, and he ain't stole my money." He walked over and shook my hand, said that was the first time he ever shook a Negro's hand, and he wanted to know how much do I owe y'all. The judge said, "You didn't let the officer present the case." "Killian, what happened?" I said, "Your Honor, he got drunk in a taxi, and the driver gave him to me for safekeeping. That's all, he was just drunk." The judge told him the fine for public drunkenness was $18. The sailor said, "That ain't enough, Judge. I got to give y'all some more." And he paid $53, and the policeman helped him out of the courtroom. He walked back over and shook my hand again. I guess I made a convert out of him.
Thank you for tuning in to Rabbit Box Radio. Tonight's stories can be found uncut and uncensored on rabbitbox.org and at facebook.com/rabbitboxstories. Of course, nothing beats the real thing, so join us the second Wednesday of each month. Laugh, love, feel the heart of Athens beat. Come share or just listen. Together we can create a stronger community, one story at a time. A special thanks to Chris Shoup and all the folks at WUGA. A thank you, of course, to the Rabbit Box staff and engineers, our storytellers, and listeners. Lastly, a big thank you to my good friends from the Triptones, whose music was recorded live on the Rabbit Box stage in September of 2016 and is now playing us out. My name is Daniel Rodriguez Granros, producer and host for today's Radio Hour, wishing you love and happy stories.